Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're there, the end of a decade. The first decade of the 21st century ends with 2009. It's been a tough 10 years. The New York Times' Frank Rich and Time Magazine's Nancy Gibbs are with us to weigh it up, size it up, speak to its character and ours, the character of a decade. But first, let's listen back, think back with a decade in sound. There was terrorism and war.
You have a second plane into the other tower, the tower of the Trade Center, major fire. Marine 6, that's the other tower.
That's the second tower of the World Trade Center.
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Listen to this, Jamie. These are shots being fired now in Baghdad. I want our viewers to listen in.
There were economic heights and economic depths.
We lived, ate, slept, and breathed Enron. I trusted the management of Enron with my life savings. They betrayed that trust. My life savings is gone.
Another milestone for the market. 14,000 on the money.
You found a flaw in the reality.
A flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
There was crisis and change.
We got children out here. We got pregnant women out here. They won't even bring water. They won't bring food.
To have this happen in the United States of America, in the state of Louisiana, and to not have immediate response is tragic.
We'll be married. We will be each other's legal spouse. It's incredible.
It's been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
There was a culture and a climate on the move.
This is their story. This is Survivor.
And we are introducing a product today that takes us exactly there. And that product is called iPod. iMac, iBook, iPod.
Michael Jackson will never die. If nothing else, his music will, you know, always be around.
This hour, On Point, we're looking back at the first decade of the 21st century. You can join the conversation. How will we remember this decade? What made it what it was, for good and ill? What's been the nature, the character of the first 10 years of this century? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, which you could not have done when this decade began. Joining me now from New York is Frank Rich, Big View columnist for the New York Times. Frank Rich, it's great to have you back.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and it's great to have you. Nancy Gibbs joins us as well. She's editor-at-large and a regular essayist at Time Magazine. Nancy, great to talk with you again as well.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Frank, first to you, how do you begin to look back on 10 years? How do you begin to take on, or can we take on board, the character? You've called it sort of the flim-flam decade. How do you put your eye on such a big chunk of time?
It's hard, particularly from such a close perspective. You know, we won't really know what this decade was for another few decades, probably. But I think we can point to a couple of big things. When I wrote about the flim-flam decade, I was talking about one strain of it, certainly, where the American people in particular feel that they've been bamboozled over and over again, whether it be by Enron or Bernie Madoff or the subprime bubble or the evidence used to take the country into war in Iraq, to hypocritical politicians who preach family values and don't practice them, and on. There's just a long list of the Ted Haggard scandal. But that's one part of the decade. Another part of the decade, I think, which you hit on in some of the clips, is a decade of radical change in terms of how everything is organized, from the music we listen to, the media we get, to how an enemy like a terrorist organization is organized, not by state, but by, indeed, website digitalization in its own way as well. And it's such a huge cultural shift that also, needless to say, affects not just NPR, but publications like the New York Times and Time Magazine that we're all sort of trying to figure out, and as is the consumer and the public.
Mm. Nancy Gibbs, it wasn't your article, but it was your magazine that made its headline on the cover of Time, The Decade from Hell. Do you see it that way, Nancy?
I don't, although I think, you know, we have to be honest that most people do. I don't know if you saw the Pew Research Center's poll this week that asked people if their overall about their overall impression of the last few decades. Mm. And by far, like twice as many people had a negative view of this decade as a positive one, which was a complete reversal of how people felt about the 90s and the 80s. I think that should just maybe be another humbling message for us about how hard it can be to assess the nature of a decade so close, as Frank suggests. I think now as we look back on the 90s, where we remember it as a decade of such luxury and peace and prosperity, and it was also glorious, except we now know that it was, you know, but that was when the economy was really in the process of turning into a casino, and how the developments that never really made headlines in any one day that were sort of happening off stage really came back in this decade on stage, where, you know, the changes in geopolitical power of the United States as the sole superpower after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was really in this decade that I think we had to reckon with what that means. The same thing with the information revolution, the same thing with, you know, the deregulation of the economy. And so in a way, I think this decade is more like a reality check, but the reality had its seeds certainly in the decades before that we now look back on so fondly.
A long, crowded, tough reality check. I'm looking here, Frank, at the latest Gallup poll. This is on American satisfaction. Are you satisfied or dissatisfied with the way things are going in the United States at this time? High point, 1999, 71%. At the very dawn of this decade, it was still 69%. That's a pretty high, good number. It is now, after a low of 8% at the end of the Bush presidency, it bumped up to 36, is now down to 25% of Americans. You know, that's down from 71 in 1999 who are satisfied with the way things are going, Frank. That's a big tumble.
Well, it is, and it obviously it reflects, the biggest thing it reflects is unemployment, which is remains a grave problem. Whatever the green shoots are in the economy affects every family in America that I know of anyway, not just as well as, of course, the poor people who have gotten poorer in America during this whole period. Tied into that is also people now fully understand the income inequality that just, you know, mushroomed over the past 20 years. And I want to go back to a point of Nancy's, because I think it's so important. Look back at those 1990s. At the time, in 1999, those happier Americans, happy because of growth in the economy, probably many of them would have said the most consequential event of the Clinton administration was the Lewinsky scandal. Looking back 10 years later, we realize the Lewinsky scandal seems to have faded so much that when there were new revelations about it that came out last week, I don't think the public blinked or shrugged or cared. On the other hand, what was considered an achievement of the Clinton administration, the promoting that growth, was carried out by an economic team that we now realize, like Alan Greenspan, had a lot of things wrong and did deregulation in a Democratic administration with bipartisan support in Congress that helped rev up the disaster that came in the decade to come.
The Lewinsky scandal now looks like patty cake compared to what we've seen in this decade. Nancy Gibbs, do you have affection for this decade, for all of its trouble and woe and war and terrorism and all? I mean, it is an unbelievable litany. Do you think Americans will try to forget the first decade of this century?
Well, I think it's, again, perspective may help us here, but I think, since I'm a hopeless optimist, I'll say that the collapse of institutions that we saw, and Frank has alluded to this, and I do think that is one of the defining features, that our loss of faith in institutions that we expected to protect us from all that flimflammery Frank talks about. I mean, flimflammery has a long and illustrious history in America, but what happened in the last 10 years is that regulators and government and the media, our institutions, and all of the groups that we expected to help keep us on course, we lost significant faith in them to do that. But at the same time, I think that one of the most important things that happened at the same time is the rise of individual power. Much of that, I think, is one of the things that makes us uncomfortable. We now know that we're all responsible for managing our own retirement. Mm. We're changing careers constantly, and we're retraining, and we're writing our own iPod apps and networking and branding, and all of that hustling can be very unsettling, but it can be very exhilarating. And I think one of the defining factors of this decade is the way that technology particularly has empowered people to take a kind of control of their life at an individual level that we have never seen before. And that's an immense egalitarian progress, and it's a global one. And I think that's another thing important to remember. We're talking about how Americans are going to look back on this decade. Large parts of the population on the planet, I think, will look back on this decade as one in which their individual freedoms and life expectancies and standards of living were higher than they had ever been before.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the decade we are wrapping up right now and how we'll look back on the first decade of the 21st century and asking what was that all about, what's been the heart, the hallmark of this decade. One big new power on the scene in this decade, China, the 2008 Summer Olympics, hosted by China. On August 8th of 08 in Beijing, the country put on quite a coming out party at its opening ceremony. You can hear some of that behind us right now. Maybe a different decade if you look at it from the Chinese point of view. What about the American? What will we tell our grandchildren about this decade? What's been the character of these 10 years? And do you remember when it started? Y2K.com bubble. Did you ever expect the 10 years that followed? Frank Rich is with us from the New York Times. Nancy Gibbs from Time Magazine. Frank, you were chief drama critic at the Times for a long time. I mean, just sit back as drama. When you look at this, you know, how would you write about it the morning after or the night of, looking on the drama of this first decade?
Well, you know, it's extraordinary in so many ways that I probably don't even have to list. But, you know, it is hilarious when you think back that we thought Y2K was going to be the apocalypse.
Right.
But when we had, you know, the most grievous attack on continental America ever, practically at the dawn of the decade, we had Hurricane Katrina, we had all the spectacle of politics, the rise of Barack Obama and Sarah Palin. It's kind of amazing. I think one other element, though, that is very important to remember is that the theatricalization of all national life, the medium as well as the content of it has stepped up so much in the past decade. At the time, it was only in the late 1990s that all the cable news networks that now are fighting each other came online, that the internet became a mass medium, and as that has snowballed throughout this decade, it's also a positive thing in terms of allowing more access to more voices, more news. At the same time, it's had the perverse effect of sort of blurring our ability to distinguish what's important from what's unimportant. So something like Balloon Boy can come and mesmerize seasoned news people for an afternoon. Also, we have to ask the question, to what extent this theater can be manipulated. And in talking, as Nancy was, about the institutions that failed, and one of them was the press, it is absolutely fascinating that in a time when we have all these news sources and we all have access to them, the whole fictional scenario that took us into Iraq got through the system, and the press failed, even though we have all these tools we didn't have before and we're more sophisticated. So the theater of it is important. It can be exciting. It can be tragic. But we also have to remember that that theater can be manipulated and disguise a reality.
Nancy, how do you look at that? It's interesting how we've got all this new information at our fingertips now. As you say, empowering individuals all over the place. I mean, AP's got a big list of sort of things that emerged in this decade. And when you look down, they're not all tech, but plenty of them. You've got apps, as in, you know, apps we carry everywhere, blogs coming into their own, connectivity. I mean, it's in there with Crocs and television dancing and internet dating, and you know, but there's Facebook and, you know, Twitter and Uggs and Wikipedia and yoga, but information all the way through that. And yet Frank Rich writes that it's been the decade of the flim-flam, where we've been more vulnerable to manipulation and being bamboozled somehow than ever before. How do you put those together, Nancy?
Well, I think it makes perfect sense, because of course all the traditional gatekeepers had to hand over their keys, and all the gates are now open. If you want to be a journalist or a designer or a software engineer or a video star or a music sensation, that technology is now in your hands and does not require for you to have a contract or a relationship with some big studio or big news organization or big computer company. And so when you have the disappearance of gatekeepers, you're going to have all sorts of stuff coming through the gates. I think one of the things that we've seen as those traditional institutions have declined is that even the notion of truth itself is on the table. The whole sort of idea of postmodern skepticism has gone very mainstream. This is the decade of truthiness that Stephen Colbert gave us. We had birthers and truthers and intelligent designers and climate change skeptics and all of these arguments, not about people's different opinions, their different ideologies, but about basic facts. And so I do think it's fascinating that at a time when information is more available to more people more easily than it ever has been, when we all are literally carrying around all of our relationships, all of our data streams in these little devices that fit in the palm of our hands, we are having such fundamental arguments, not just about what we believe, but about what we know.
I want to ask you, is Frank?
I was just going to say, and the one problem with this is when you get beyond the meta issues, you know, like climate change or Afghanistan or whatever, and people's different perceptions of them, and everyone having indeed, you know, his or her own opinion, own blog often. At the more micro level, it's a real problem, particularly about things like the economy, because you know, there can be 5,000 bloggers who have an opinion about, say, a Fortune 500 company that's selling its stock on the New York Stock Exchange. But what are the facts? As Americans want to figure out what to do with a 401k or their savings. So there's a lot of chaos. It may settle down over time, but in the absence of authoritative gatekeepers, sometimes we need gatekeepers, not in the sense of the old sense that they're above their readership or they're just establishment for the sake of being establishment. We do need agreement on the facts, or we cannot go forward as a democracy. We have to have basic facts that are certifiable and true, and then we can all have our opinions about them.
Wasn't it Daniel Patrick Moynihan that everyone's entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts?
And now we've all got our own facts or something like them.
And I think that has really made, you know, there's been so much conversation recently about what has come of civil discourse, particularly when the country is facing the kinds of challenges we are now, trying to solve problems like health care, or how you create jobs, or adjusting to a more energy-independent economy, trying to tackle problems like that when there isn't even basic disagreement on the facts on the table, I think becomes so much harder, and it becomes, of course, so much easier for people with vested interests, whether economic or ideological, to really take over and drive the debate and make it much harder for sort of practical solutions and substantive arguments to occur outside of an environment of real polarization.
And we surely see that on huge display in Washington. Nancy Frank, stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. A lot lined up here. More welcome. What do you think? Is Time Magazine right? Was this the decade from hell? Is Frank Rich right? Was this the flim-flam decade from Enron to Tiger Woods? And what moved you in this decade? What changed you? 800-423-8255 is our number. Here's a web post from Pablo who says, how about a global perspective? This was one of the greatest decades in human history if you think about the number of people who were lifted out of poverty in China, India, Brazil, and so forth. The U.S. did not have a great decade, Pablo writes, thanks to terrible policymaking here at home. But elsewhere, this was an incredible span of years. I think a lot of Chinese, just for starters, would agree. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont. Joe, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Joe. You're on.
Yeah, I think Time Magazine has it right.
You think Time Magazine has it right? And that's about all we got from you there. Joe, I'm sorry I lost you. Let's go to Chris in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Hi, good.
I'm a recent college grad. I started this decade entering high school, sitting down to my high school guidance counselor in 2001. And I'm sure I don't speak only for myself, but a lot of people in my scenario, when I say that, you know, we made all these plans, you know, for college and careers at the end of the 90s, and we've gotten here now and kind of looking around and saying, where was the world you told me was going to be here?
Is this all there is?
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, I have a younger sister now getting ready to start college. She's asking me for advice, and I don't know what to tell her. You know, things would look a lot different than when I made those plans.
Frank Rich, put yourself in Chris's shoes for a minute. Coming out of high school at the beginning of this decade with the 90s behind you in your childhood and looking forward, I mean, maybe it's helpful to look back on other decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, for a sense of perspective here. You know, Chris feels kind of whipsawed by what he expected and what he got.
Well, I completely sympathize and understand, because his chronology is such that he indeed emerged into the so-called adult world or the real world at the height of a boom, when the country was really having a kind of wonderful escape from history and reality. You know, we didn't think about Al-Qaeda. We didn't think that a Wall Street bubble or a dot-com bubble could burst. And so he was encouraged. His generation was encouraged to make plans based on this false reality, just as, you know, what would follow is the whole economy was based on the proposition that housing prices could never go down. So it's an enormous adjustment. I think that the only thing that can be said is this is not the first time in human history that this has happened, that expectations have been dashed, and including in our own history. You look at the 1920s, for instance, which was a very, in many ways, a strikingly similar boom followed by a downturn worse than the one that even we've had. And people got through it. In some cases, my generations, my parents lived through that. And you know, the world turned. Things changed. This country is resilient. That's pretty thin gruel in the immediate present. But there's really no choice but to hang in. And frankly, my own feeling is, from knowing a lot of people of the caller's generation, including contemporaries of my own children who are roughly his age, I have a lot of hope because of them. I think that they're still the same smart, capable people they were before all this happened. And I just think many of them are working very hard to try to re-envision what America can be at all levels, and to try to unmake some of the messes made by their parents.
Nancy, what do you say to Chris calling in, you know, wondering about what's been handed him here? I mean, from the perspective of having seen a few more decades, what do you say to Americans of his age about this one?
Well, I think one thing that it's shocking for us older people to realize is that for most of today's, say, entering college freshmen, the year that they were born, a majority of whites in this country still disapproved of interracial marriage. Would that generation of people have voted for a mixed-race president and a black first lady? That they were born the year that the Soviet Union collapsed. The Dow was at 3,000, and the first commercial text message was ever sent. It was such a different world. And the speed of change that today's kids have lived through, I think, I hope, prepares them better than we can. We're preparing them for jobs that don't yet exist using technologies we haven't invented yet. And so I think trying to tell kids now anything reasonable about what they should expect coming at them would just be naive, because the pace at which our economy and our tools have been changing is, I think, really unprecedented in our history. And so I think, you know, in a way, I'm inclined to think my children will be teaching me as much or more as I'm ever going to be teaching them. I see that every time they take my BlackBerry from me and fix it or reprogram it.
A kind of turnaround there, a source of hope, we hope. Let's get a call from Sterling Heights, Michigan. Seth. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
Good. The comment I would like to make about the last decade is that I think something that's unique about it is that both conservatives and liberals seem to be dissatisfied. I mean, typically when you'd have a major turning point in our nation's history, one side or the other would say that things were going quite well while the other would disagree. And I'm curious if the panelists could perhaps comment on that. And one cause of that, perhaps, that I think is that people just can't see how society will reproduce itself. We seem to be at a major turning point, and a lot of people aren't optimistic about the future. I think the idea of social reproduction should be, perhaps we could talk about that. And, that's it.
Seth, let us pick it up. Frank, you end your column on the decade we've been through saying that, you know, we're left mired in a sand trap with no obvious way out. And Seth pointing out you've got both right and left quite unhappy.
I think that's exactly right. I think that what this talks about is a failure of the political system in this country, particularly in Washington. Whatever side you are on the issues of the day, starting with, for instance, health care reform, what we've seen is a really ugly legislative process with people on both sides looking after their political interests, or sometimes their most venal and craven financial interests, ahead of the voters and the American population. And this has often been a strain in American politics. You know, it didn't just begin yesterday of plague on all their houses, and both parties are failing, and liberalism and conservatism are failing. But we see it, I think, in part because of the explosion in mass communication. We see it much more clearly and vividly and transparently in a way than we did even 10 years ago. And it's going to have to be reformed, and it's going to have to be reformed, I think, from the bottom up. That's what the Obama movement was about. And I think while it's ridiculous to write Obama off by any stretch of the imagination, and indeed his force to change things may still be quite powerful. He's not even a full year into his first term yet. Nonetheless, when you hear people being disappointed to some extent with Obama, it isn't just his political enemies who didn't like him in the first place. It's a lot of people in the middle who voted for him, whatever their party affiliation, because they believed in his message, and I'm sure Obama sincerely believed in it too, that there could be change brought into Washington in this whole process. And he has learned the hard way that people are dug in, including his own party. And it's a problem. The Senate has really become, I think, something of a national joke during the course of this health care debate, however it turned out. And we're going to have to deal with it. It's going to have to happen, I think, at the grassroots level. And that's why you see rump groups on both the right and the left, in some, however inchoate way, trying to articulate this. We don't have any really national politician who has articulated it better than Obama, but someone could come along with a version of it that might challenge Obama's idea of change and really create an interesting debate in this country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back this hour on the decade we are wrapping up right now, how we'll look back on the first decade of the 21st century and asking, what was that all about? What's been the heart, the hallmark of this decade? Nancy Gibbs joins us from Time Magazine, editor-at-large there. Frank Rich of the New York Times is with us as well, author of The Greatest Story Ever Told, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. And Nancy with Michael Duffy, author of The Preacher and the Presidents, Billy Graham in the White House. We had to look for those moments in this decade that bucked the country up. Some were very dramatic. Here's January this year, U.S. Airways flight out of LaGuardia on its way to North Carolina 6 minutes after leaving the airport. Captain Sully Sullenberger brought the plane down and all 155 passengers and crew on the Hudson River.
This guy was phenomenal because
saved our lives.
We were hitting that Hudson River with full impact and it went boom. And then we stopped.
And boy, we couldn't stop talking about it. It was great, but maybe because there just weren't, it seemed, enough of those moments in this decade. Let's get a call from Phil in Cheshire, Connecticut. Phil, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. What a pleasure to have you and Frank Rich
and Nancy
on today.
Right here. It's great. Yeah.
In addition to you being my interviewer of the decade, I'd like to say I think Time Magazine got it all wrong. I would have named Elizabeth Warren as the person of the year and person of the decade. The financial sector has taken on way, way too much importance and power in our overall economy, and people like Ben Bernanke are just going to keep it there. We need more Elizabeth Warrens to put the financial sector in its place, make it honest. And if I were President Obama or his counselor, I would urge him to fire all those guys and make Elizabeth Warren, the Secretary Treasurer, and let her put a team together that would put our financial sector back in the place that it belongs.
Phil, we've got it. Elizabeth Warren talking about the end of the American middle class. We've got posters online saying a similar thing about this decade. David saying we witnessed a massive shift of wealth from the middle class to the very wealthy. Here's Christopher calling this decade the darkest years of American history, beginning with the absurd debacle of the 2000 election, September 11th, Bush's inept response, Iraq. Dee says the story of this decade will be the beginning of the official end of the American empire. Let's go to Janet in Reading, Massachusetts. Janet, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to say I think that it's short-sighted to think in terms of 10 years. You have a swing always in human nature between self-interest and idealism. And I think the last 100 years, our standards have been very high. And our image, therefore, of how we think we're acting is always better than how we're really acting. And that applies to Tiger Woods. He's just another man. And he's just acting like most men act, I'm sorry to say. You know, these Enron and these other companies, they were acting like that for years. It just got found out recently. And it's only in the last 100 years that we've really had so many of the social protections that we've come to rely on and think of as normal. And those social protections are not available today in many countries.
Yeah, Janet, we've got it. On the other hand, 100 years is a pretty long time for setting a precedent if in fact, we're swinging away from that now. Nancy Gibbs, what do you make of Janet and our poster D saying it's the beginning of the end of the American empire this decade?
Well, I do think that the call for some patience in making these assessments makes sense. You know, if we go back to where we were 10 years ago, which is, you know, back in 1999 when we were still watching TV on TVs and reading newspapers on newspaper, you know, people were stockpiling chicken chow mein and bottled water in anticipation of what was going to happen on December 31st, 1999. And then when the Y2K apocalypse didn't happen, everyone thought, oh, okay, we're in the clear. Well, it turns out, I think, that it just happened in slow motion. And all of the collapses that had been anticipated in some of those apocalyptic scenarios, we ended up getting. I mean, the financial system really did end up coming close to melting down in this past year, and governmental institutions and other sort of basic structures in society. It just happened it didn't happen all at once overnight because of some computer glitch. And so I think the flip side of that is when you were asking about where is restoration and revitalization likely to come from. I don't think it's likely to come overnight. I don't think it's going to be imposed from the top down. I have enormous faith in the power of individual imagination and ingenuity. For better or worse, 10 years ago, there was no iPod, there were no smartphones, there was no YouTube or Twitter or Rachel Ray or any number of other technological and cultural landmarks, for better or worse. And so 10 years from now, we have no idea what will have come onto the scene and fundamentally transformed how we relate to each other or how we function as citizens. But I think that, you know, we were talking about in the last election about people feeling that maybe there is a possibility of individual power in our political process that was activated in that election cycle in a way it hadn't been before. And then I think was perhaps disappointed when the first thing that seemed to happen was the president elected on a wave of that individual entrepreneurial political energy turned over to Congress the power to write the largest spending bill in history. I think what I'm waiting to see and what I'm most curious about is whether that demand for individual power and voices of individuals will take on greater importance than the voices we've been listening to all year in what has been the most closely watched legislative battle, I think, in our lifetimes. We all know a lot more about what it takes to affect political change than we did a year ago. You know, if you just see the vocabulary that is now commonplace in news stories about marking up a bill and filibusters and how vote counting works and the kinds of trade-offs that are being made, we've all had a political education this year that has been ugly and dispiriting in many ways, but that I can't help but expect is going to affect the way people vote and organize themselves and make themselves heard going forward.
Frank, off of what we're hearing, a couple of questions for you. First, to our poster D, saying it's the beginning of the end of the American empire or the American era. I wonder how you see that. And off of your own column on the decade, calling this the decade of the flim-flam, when Americans were bamboozled so often, my question for you is, why have Americans been so bamboozleable?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. And I do think that one issue that we have to address going forward as a people is our ability to be so credulous and taken in again and again, whether it be by leaders in Washington or Wall Street or, you know, celebrities, our media. This is a country where we question, you know, E. coli in our spinach, but often we do not question the diet of the media we consume and how we pick among our choices and try to separate truth from truthiness.
Is that an end of empire dynamic, Frank?
No, that's not an end of empire dynamic. And like Nancy, I feel very sanguine and optimistic about the level of innovation, inventiveness in this country. We have some of the smartest people spending day and night thinking up things to make people's lives better, to make the environment better, to make public discourse and democracy better. That said, we're always in jeopardy. Nothing is assured. We're still a very young country. We don't know we're going to continue at this pace for, you know, hundreds of years to go. And there's some real systemic problems that have to be addressed that Obama often campaigned on addressing that are serious, including income inequality, the collapse of parts of our education system, the collapse of a lot of our infrastructure, the whole situation of producing jobs in this economy that's transforming so fast, and where basically manufacturing is coming to an end. All of this has to be addressed so that the diamonds of innovation and of entrepreneurship, of creativity, scientific invention, all of it can flourish. They don't have a context of a society that's functioning at every level and where everyone gets a fair stake in it. They can only take us so far. So it's a real, we're at a crossroads, I think, some of it brought on by the rapid changes in history, some by ourselves and our own failures, and we have to deal with it to assure that America, I don't, empire or no empire, that's a separate issue, that America will
live in the way we're used to it doing so.
Let's hear from Zach in Charleston, South Carolina. Zach, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just making the point. I think we've heard a lot of bad news today, but it seems that Americans as a whole are much better off today than we were in 2000. Certainly, everyone's stock portfolio has taken a hit, and we have less wealth, but it seems like our quality of life is much better than it was.
In what sense, Zach? In what sense do you see it as better off? That's great. How so?
Well, I mean, I'm young. I'm, like the previous caller, I'm not that far out of college, but, you know, I've seen bad things happen, obviously, in my short time, but we've seen the stock market go down, but we've also seen the stock market go down tons of times before, and it's always come back up. And I just think that we really, as was stated, just need to make the case for optimism and innovation and continuing to just work hard. You know, we certainly didn't get anywhere by waiting for Washington to kind of step in and pave the way for us. It was individuals and companies and people just getting together and wanting to do better.
Make that case for optimism. Amen to that. Undergird it with some structures that bring education and so on, probably necessary as well. But it's interesting, Nancy. I mean, here's a young generation that talk about being inoculated. If you grew up in the face of 9/11 and Iraq and Afghanistan and economic collapse in this decade, you know, if you bring your optimism to the table after all that, you're pretty tough.
And, you know, this he actually does speak for a generation mm-hmm. because if you look at what, you know, the recent polling is finding, people between 18 and 29 are the most likely to think that the next decade is going to be better than this one. 65% of them think it's going to be better. Whereas, and the older you get, the less likely you are to think that. And so people over 50, almost half of them think the next decade is going to be worse. And so I'm very heartened by the fact that the generation that is going to be in the position to help make the next decade better has the most hope in their own ability to do that.
Ready to step up with that gleam in the eye. Jordan in Asheville, North Carolina. You're on the air, Jordan.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're well. What do you see, Jordan?
Well, actually, I'm also from the same age demographic as some of your past callers, a recent college grad.
Great.
Trying to make it with a degree that's actually not really doing much for me. But, you know, while I think that people in my age group, we are optimistic because I don't really see how it could get much worse. But I think we also do feel let down by the government and by, you know, just by the whole world that we were raised when we were in the 90s to believe that it was always going to be that great and it was always going to be, you know, step by step. You go to high school, you go to college, you get a job, or you go to grad school. And it's just not that simple. And I think a lot of us are just looking around and saying, well, what happened? But the other thing that always also worries me is that with the information age and information overload, you know, there's Facebook, there's all these interactive websites, and we have joined together in a sense, but we've also learned to separate ourselves. And in doing so, I find that a lot of my peers, if they don't actually make a point to care, they don't care anything.
Jordan, you're breaking up, but I'm really glad for your call and your point there. Frank Rich, I mean, you hear the hope and determination in this generation, but also it is daunting what they're up against. 50-somethings may not have as bright a view, but they sure can't, in good conscience, check out on these younger generations of Americans stepping out of this decade with big challenges in front of them. Everybody's going to have to put their shoulder to the wheel here.
Absolutely, and I do think As Nancy was saying before, one of the positive developments of this past decade, the empowering of the individual to take charge of everything in your life, including being active in issues that you care about and trying to do something even at the local level, doesn't mean just joining a national political campaign, but trying to save a school system or try to find jobs for people, try to deal with all the issues before us, everyone can play a role, and anyone who's fit and able has to play a role regardless of age. And that's such a positive thing because, you know, as we know, elderly people are often completely proficient on the Internet, are much more involved in many cases than they would have been 10 years ago because there are these tools and the whole world has opened up to everybody. And so we now have to pool that energy in a way that moves us forward, and everyone has to be involved.
We've got more calls we're just not going to get to. Sam in Troy, Michigan says, what about the economy? You know, it's gone downhill in this last decade. Must turn that around. Henrik, another college student calling in, Middlebury, Vermont, says he feels a swirling distrust of capitalism out there. Not sure how that will play out, but he sees it all around him. Nancy Gibbs, we head out of this decade with so many unknowns. End of the 90s, you could say, well, deficits are coming down. We've had a boom. We've got all kinds of new technology. We're ready to rock. And then it didn't work that way. This time, all kinds of burdens and deficits. But just talk about unknown. Couldn't be more unknown where we're headed.
It couldn't be, but again, I almost would liken this to the moment we found ourselves on September 10th of 2001, when we all felt so safe and so secure, and on September 12th, we didn't. And yet, you could argue that we were actually less safe on September 10th because of what we didn't know. The only thing that had really changed was how we felt and what our knowledge was. And so I would say that the corollary to that now is that I think we're much more aware of uncertainty and the risk of making glib predictions about how either the economy or technology or our political life is likely to unfold. We have been surprised so many times that we have no business being surprised by that experience.
Yeah, well, it is well and truly said. It's all out on the table now. We'll see what we make of it. Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large at Time Magazine. It's been great to have you today, Nancy. Thank you so much for being here. And Frank Rich, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Always wonderful to have you, Frank. Have a great decade. This next one, Frank, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Let me tell you what a great crew we've got right here. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Suzanne Merkelson and Patrick Rosso, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.